AP Radio News. I'm Tim McGuire. President Obama and Cuba's Raul Castro met for about an hour yesterday at the Summit of the Americas in Panama, the first meeting of the two country leaders in a half century.
We agreed that we can continue to take steps forward that advance our mutual interests. We'll continue to work toward reestablishing diplomatic relations, reopening embassies in Havana and Washington, and encouraging greater contacts and commerce and exchanges between our citizens.
Sometime later today, Hillary Rodham Clinton is expected to put a video online announcing she's running for president.
Who's going to win the election?
They chanted her name, they carried ready for Hillary signs, and they wore stickers that said the same thing. Trudy Mason, vice chair of the New York State Democratic Committee, says there's so much enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton, the candidate.
My phone has been ringing off the hook. My cell phone, my landline. People want to get involved.
But she says they mostly want to let Clinton know.
If I can sum it up, you go, girl.
Mason says she expects to play a role in the campaign. Julie Walker, New York.
Saturday Night Live poked fun at Clinton's presumed candidacy.
Citizens, you will elect me. I will be your leader.
Okay, great. Let's stop there.
In a video posted online, power saws, sledgehammers, a bulldozer, finally explosives were seen used by the Islamic State group to destroy the ruins of an ancient Assyrian city in Iraq. Pope Francis says the 1915 massacre of tens of thousands of Armenians by Ottoman Turks was genocide. AP's Nicole Winfield reports Francis' declaration is aimed at Turkey and its allies, including the U.S.
He says if you conceal or deny evil, you're just letting the wound fester. So this pronouncement is his way of saying, let's call a spade. You can't hide behind euphemisms. Let's confront it and move on.
This is AP Radio News. A day after Walter Scott was buried, the Reverend Al Sharpton is in North Charleston, South Carolina. Sharpton is there to preach at a local church, and he will also be attending a memorial for Walter Scott. Scott was killed last week when he ran away from a white police officer, shot several times. That police officer has been arrested and faces possible murder charges. Rapper Nelly was arrested in Tennessee. State police found methamphetamine and a small amount of marijuana on his tour bus when it was stopped last night. It was pulled over for not displaying a U.S. Department of Transportation sticker or the International Fuel Tax Association sticker. Nelly has posted $10,000 in bond. I'm Tim McGuire, AP Radio News.
Hey, Mom, why is the sky blue? Why don't animals talk? Why do dogs have wet noses? Why is an 11 pronounced 1T1?
Kids ask a lot of questions.
Why do I have a belly button?
But you don't have to know every answer.
Why is the ocean salty?
Because you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent.
Why are there 50 states?
There are thousands of children in foster care who don't need every question answered.
Why is pizza round?
They just need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
In the small town of Elmira, New York, a boy was born into an all-American family. The odds of him achieving his dream in the fashion industry? 1 in 23 million. The odds of having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 68. I am Tommy Hilfiger, and my family is affected by autism. Learn more at autismspeaks.org/signs. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Okay, so 5 tacos of cheese and a large soda, that's $10,012. Please drive around.
Wait, 10,000 what?
It's obvious you're buzzed and driving.
I've only had a few. I'm fine.
Yeah, the food's $12, but getting pulled over for buzz driving could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Please drive around. Actually, just park and come in.
Nothing kills a buzz like getting pulled over for buzz driving, because buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
This is Mark Amtower. With lower margins, your limited marketing budget has to work harder than ever. LinkedIn is one of the most robust marketing platforms available. With over 350 million members worldwide, 110 million in the U.S., and 3.1 million members within 50 miles of this station, I guarantee your customers and prospects are here. Connect, influence, motivate, create leads. I can show you how. When you want to maximize the return on your LinkedIn presence, email me at mark@federaldirect.net.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the offices of Optifor Integrated Wealth Management. This is your host, Les Smolin, with my co-hosts, Mark Cohn, Joe Applebaum, and Kristen Vozo. We've got a great lineup of guests for you today. Mark, could you go through that lineup, please?
Sure, Les. First, we're going to start with Joe Martori, CEO and President of Caliber Systems. Then Randy Tharp, Founder, CEO, and President of Vet Sports. Third will be Kelly Sweeney McShane, the president and CEO of Community of Hope. And we're going to end with Shai Palavani, founder of Live Safe.
Thank you, Mark. So first up is Joe Martori. Joe, what is Caliber Systems?
Caliber Systems is a management consulting and information technology solutions firm. 100% of our company is owned by our employees, and we provide financial management, logistics analysis, and human capital management for the Defense Department and federal agencies.
And how'd you get started with them?
I got started with Caliber when they bought my company, one of the companies that I had started in 2004.
And they bought you because why?
They bought us because we had some capabilities with the Department of Energy that they were looking to diversify into, and also we were running the Army's Base Realignment and Closure Program, and that was a program that was growing in 2005, and they wanted to get into that piece of the action.
Mm-hmm. And so when did you get into the present role that you're in as CEO and president?
I ran one of the divisions for the first 3 years and then was asked to stay on as president, and about 5 years ago became president and CEO.
So why you, Joe?
Why me? I think one of the founding members who was the CEO and wanted to retire believed that he could trust in me and the people and the team that I brought to Caliber. We had similar values and beliefs in our serving our customers and our employees, and also giving back to the community.
And why was that so important to them at that time, or at least the founder at that time?
It was important because he had started Caliber in 1989, and this was 20 years later, and was looking to continue the legacy that he had started, as well as the employees looking for the same thing because they were invested as owners.
So you mentioned earlier that the company is 100% owned by its employees?
It is. It is 95% owned by employee stock ownership plan and the other 5% by individual employees.
So do you have to run it differently as a result?
Well, and to some extent, it's easier because I have 100% of our employees thinking like owners. And we'd like to say think as owners, not renters. And mm-hmm. as a result, they do more. They invest their time. They invest their efforts. And they invest the company's resources for the success of the employee, the company and our customers. But on the other hand, it's a little bit different because when I speak with them, and I do frequently, I tell them all that I work for them.
So, well, that's interesting. You work for them? That's not the picture we usually get.
I work for the employee owners of Caliber.
So does that really work? You got how many employees?
We have 725 employees.
So it's kind of like you have 700 bosses.
I do.
How do you keep them straight?
Well, one of the things is hopefully they like the vision and the strategy that I set, and they're willing to help execute.
Vision and strategy. So let's go back a little bit in time. What was your first paying job as a kid, somewhere between 8 and 12 perhaps?
Well, somewhere between 8 and 12, I was focused on school and education and my family and my faith.
School and education. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in the Boston area.
Mm-hmm. Any siblings?
I have I'm the oldest of four. I have a sister and two younger brothers.
Mm-hmm. Being the oldest, does that matter in the pecking order in your house?
Not if you ask them, but I think there is there's an expectation that I set a role model, I become a role model for them, and that I help keep the family close.
Well, why was that your responsibility and not mom and dad's?
Well, it was theirs also, but I think as especially as we got older and we left the family and started our own, that they continued to look to me as well as my parents, but to me for advice and for help and for bringing keeping the family together.
What do you think they saw in you? That basically, I mean, you know, I have an older brother, but we don't operate like that. So what is it they saw in you that said there's somebody we can actually turn to?
Well, I think this is an evolving situation. Early on, they probably saw an older brother who was not very kind to them, but one that grew and realized that they all are different. They have different personalities. They have different things to offer, and they had confidence that I would do the right things.
Well, you said you grew up in Boston. You had three siblings. You're the oldest. Keeping the family together, isn't that like keeping a corporate culture together?
It is, and I probably shouldn't have used the word keeping the family together. Our family is very close, both our parents and our immediate family, as well as many cousins and uncles and aunts. So that was not really the story, but it was really trying to make sure that we stayed together and thought of each other.
Right.
But it is like a corporate culture.
You had said that, you know, the thread that runs through the company is tell me the truth, and you hire the smartest people you can find. So you're leading this band of 724 other people. And so how do you correlate that to being sort of the head of the family?
I think you're exactly right. The one of the best things that I can do in either the corporate or the family environment is to listen, and to listen and to recognize that there are different perspectives and different strategies, and just be a part of it. Be a part of the team.
So at one point you mentioned in the green room that you were thinking about going into the ministry.
Yes.
So how does that play into your leadership?
Well, as I think I said earlier, faith was very important to our family. And that's kept us together. It plays into leadership because, again, it's the word is leader. It's not boss. It's not director. It's leader. And if you can have the right approaches and have the right vision, people will tend to follow.
So, what does it mean to lead in your world?
In my world, to lead is to establish a vision and a strategy, to engage a team of individuals, to be a team, and to give them, empower them to execute, and then to oversee.
Joe, going back to your family, who do you think you take after more, your mom or your dad?
I think I take after both of them, and hopefully the good qualities from both. My father was a very good engineer and an entrepreneur, and I learned a lot from him in terms of dealing with his clients and dealing with employees. And my mother was a solid force in terms of setting our personalities and what was important to us and what we should be looking forward to in the future.
You said something earlier, just to kind of build off of what Kristen is saying. When you were younger, you liked to take tests.
Yes.
What was that about?
I always felt that if you had a test, there was a right answer and a wrong answer, and if you studied or if you had the aptitude, you could get the right answer.
I think
that applies today in the business world, that if one works hard and listens to one's clients, that you can help get the right answer and be successful.
And someone asked earlier as well during the green room about, well, what do you do with a wrong answer?
You use that as a learning experience for both for yourself and for the individual that maybe had got the wrong answer, and help to understand what the right answer is and how to get to it next time.
Mm-hmm. So something you also said earlier, you weren't always running this company, and you had started at least one, if not several, companies before that.
Yes, when I left the government, I worked for the government in the 80s. I joined a smaller company that we eventually took public. And as a result of that, I was able to give back to a homeless foundation in the Boston area where we were from and where my kids had actually worked in some homeless activities. And then started two other firms and sold one of them in 1997 and the other one in 2004 to Caliber.
Why was it important to give back?
Again, that was part of what we learned from our parents, that if we were given things and were able to achieve certain things, that it was important to give back to others, to other people that in the community and others that had needs.
Joe, if you were president and CEO of Caliber, what would you be doing?
I probably would have started another company. I enjoy the entrepreneurial experience, the ability to take risks and manage those risks, and to create something where we're another one of the people you're interviewing today talked about being able to accomplish things that others say are impossible.
Hmm. Where's that come from for you? Where'd you learn that lesson?
Probably reading a book.
Really? And why did it stick with you?
Well, it sticks because one of the things that I try to do is when I lead a company or a group of people is to give them something that they can hold on to. And that is one, the ability to take risks. And our employees know that it's acceptable to take risks. In fact, we encourage that. No one would be walking today if they were afraid to fall down when they started. So, you know, in our case, we want to take risks. We want to manage those. But we also want to establish aggressive goals. And so I like a quote from Michelangelo that says, "The greatest danger for most of us is not setting our goals too high and failing, but setting them too low and accomplishing them."
That's wonderful. Where does faith fit in that?
It's just a part of the another part of my being, of my personality, but there's an expectation then that that we really should try to make a difference in the communities that we live in.
So when you ask people to take risks, what's the real risk in all of that if we don't achieve what we set out to do?
Well, in a company like Caliber that is employee-owned, the real risk is we have over 700 employees whose retirement plans, whose portfolio is made up in large part their investment in Caliber. And if we take risks and fail, there's a possibility that share price won't continue to increase and might impact individuals.
Thank you, Joe. Joe, what's the website?
It's www.calibersys.com.
We've been speaking with Joe Martori, CEO and President of Caliber Systems. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be right back in a moment after this business spotlight. This is Les Smolin with Vistage International, and this is your business spotlight. Joining us today is Randy Tharp, Director of the 5-9 Group. Welcome, Randy. Randy, what is the 5-9 Group?
The 5-9 Group is an IT services company here in D.C., and we provide application solutions, DevOps, and program management for the federal government.
Mm-hmm. And what's your role in the company?
I'm the Director of Business Development.
So that means what?
So that means I'm the guy responsible for gaining new business.
Mm-hmm. And so what is it that makes the organization special in your view?
Well, the company was created out of the role that they play. It's called 5-9, so 99.999% availability is what our goal is, to serve our customers.
And what do they appreciate about you guys?
They appreciate that we can actually deliver that.
Mm-hmm. And who is the perfect client in your mind?
The perfect client is one who understands that we are one of the leaders and we're the innovators behind them, and they hired us for a reason and they let us do our jobs.
And what is it about the work that you enjoy most?
Well, the work we enjoy most is because it's on high availability critical systems for the federal government. For example, DHS or Census Bureau, managing these databases are very important to the taxpayers and to America, so we take that very serious.
Mm-hmm. And what would you say that the clients get from all this work? Where's the value in it for them?
The value is being able to count on an industry leader, on a contractor like us, to get the job done and be available 24/7 to keep things going for them and bring solutions that matter.
That's great. And you got a website?
We do. It's www.59group.com.
Thanks, Randy. We've been speaking with Randy Tharp, Director, 5-9 Group. This is Les Smolin, and that's been your Business Spotlight.
This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining me for this segment is Doug Kay, who is a principal with a firm called Offutt Kerman. What is Offutt Kerman, Doug?
Offutt Kerman is a full-service law firm in the Mid-Atlantic region, with offices from Philadelphia all the way down to Tyson's Corner, Virginia, where I work.
Right. And you're a lawyer with the firm?
I'm a lawyer with the firm.
What practice area do you specialize in?
I mostly do work in commercial litigation, although I also do work in doing criminal defense and personal injury, anything that gets me to trial.
Anything that gets you to trial. Well, why do your customers appreciate you?
I think they appreciate me because I am a careful and sympathetic listener. And I try to offer concrete solutions to their most vexing legal problems.
Well, give us an example. Do you have one, without mentioning specifics, a recent example of where you were really good at this? How about your favorite client up till now, without getting into too particulars there?
Well, I represented a fellow who was in a commercial lease, and the landlord was determined to make him pay more than he should have been paying. And we had to go to court, and we had to go all the way through trial, and the client really appreciated the effort, and we got an excellent result for the client. And that was very satisfying, and since then he's been talking me up all over town, so I can't thank him enough.
Yeah. What's the best part of practicing law for you?
I would say that it is taking people through difficult circumstances when they think they don't have any options and trying to find a good solution for them.
Great. What's the website address for the law firm?
www.offutkerman.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Doug Kay, who's the principal with Offutt Kerman. This is Peter Schwartz, and that was your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Les Smolin, with my co-host, excuse me, Mark Cohn, Joe Applebaum, and Kristen Vozo. Our next guest is Kelly Sweeney McShane, President and CEO of Community of Hope. Kelly, welcome. Kelly, what is the Community of Hope?
Community of Hope is a nonprofit based in Washington, D.C. that works with low-income and homeless families. We provide housing with supportive services as well as a whole range of health care.
And how big or small is it?
We're about a $16 million budget with about 200 employees. And last year, we served over 10,000 people in our combined programs.
That's amazing. And what was it that kind of drew you to this?
I was really drawn by the mission. And the mission really focuses on a lot of the issues that I think that impact poverty, which include affordable housing, include health care and keeping people health and safety, includes increasing people's income, and having a good education as well.
And so you got the job recently, or how did you get the
job? I've been here for 14 years.
14 years?
Yes.
As the president and CEO?
Yes, the entire time.
So what were you doing right before that actually said, hey, she's eminently qualified to do this?
So I had run another smaller nonprofit and then went back to business school and got me my MBA.
So what do you think they saw in you at that point that said, here, we've got something for you?
Well, I think and hope they saw just really my passion for the cause and for the issues. And I had gone back to get my business degree because I feel like there's so many nonprofits that have great ideas and visions, but if you don't know how to manage the people or manage the money, it's really hard to accomplish that mission.
So is that something you kind of brought?
Yes, I definitely brought more comfort with finances, with managing people, with thinking strategically.
Mm. And it sounds like you've had a good run of success so far.
It's gone pretty well.
Good. So you had told us a little bit earlier you kind of grew up in the suburbs of Texas, right?
No, I actually grew up outside the United States till I was about 11 years old. Was in Pakistan and Colombia, and then ended up in Houston, Texas.
You were moving around a lot there.
I did move around a lot.
So what was Dad or Mom doing that made this happen?
So my dad worked with Exxon, and so we moved about every 3 to 5 years. And then my mom was holding down the fort and keeping all the kids and everything organized at home.
How many kids are we talking about here?
I was second of five children.
Second of five. Are you the first female or
I am. I'm the oldest girl.
So being the oldest girl out of five, how does that impact you, especially when you're not here in the United States, so you grew up in a different environment?
Right. Well, when we were living overseas, I was also the girl in the middle of the two boys, so they would get arguing, and I'd just go to my room and read my book and stay out of it. And then when we moved to Texas, my sister was 10 years younger, so it was Mom, the baby's crying, but also ended up sort of being her mother in some ways with the age difference as well.
Mm-hmm. So Mom was taking care of the family?
Yes.
And Dad was more the entrepreneur you had mentioned?
Yes. He worked for Exxon for many years, and then when we moved back to Houston, decided to leave the company and started up a whole bunch of businesses, including a radio station and a travel agency and a whole bunch of different small businesses.
So what do you think, given the first 11 years of your life you spent overseas, and not necessarily in luxurious capitals of the world, how did that affect you growing up?
So I've always been drawn to international work. I was also a Peace Corps volunteer right out of college and just really felt like it's given me a great perspective on the world and how different people live in different parts of the world and what poverty looks like in different parts of the world.
So why does that matter in terms of how you run an organization?
I think it's really good to understand people who are different than you, and how do you welcome that and build on strengths and work in different cultures, and especially these days with the importance of diversity and how great it is to, that it brings an asset to a company. So that's been really important.
Well, let me ask a question. Kelly, you said an asset to a company, but you're just a nonprofit organization. You have people who volunteer and some people that are on staff, but that's not a company, right?
So it's definitely a company. It's definitely a business, and I think it's we do have a goal of making sure the money is managed well as that people are happy employees. We were actually one of 150 top workplaces in the Washington Post last year that's very proud
fantastic.
Of.
Fantastic. So it is a business.
It is definitely a business.
So what's that unique gift that you bring to business that you learned as a child, perhaps?
I don't know if as a child, but I think I'm really good at thinking strategically about what direction we need to go and how the shifting sands work. I also think I bring a good sense of humor to the work, and especially working with families who are homeless, it's often very difficult work, and it's really important to keep up morale and keep ourselves healthy as well.
Can you give us an example of your sense of humor?
Ooh, that's a good one. Well, we're all going ropes climbing as a staff in a few weeks, and apparently I'm supposed to try the zip line, so we'll see how that goes and what pictures come out of that one. So
so it's kind of putting yourself up for...
Right.
Go ahead, Kristen.
So that leads me to a question. What's the scariest thing that you've ever done, Kelly?
So I think maybe not scariest, but very intense is I have a youngest daughter adopted from Sierra Leone where I was in the Peace Corps that nobody knew about until, of course, Ebola and everything has been happening. We went back about 5 years ago to visit. And it was my daughter has three brothers, and they didn't know we were coming. So we showed up in the country. We drove around the capital. We found her family. I was speaking a different language in an incredibly poor country. With three young kids that I was bringing with me and my husband for the first time. So it was a pretty intense experience.
What made it so intense for you?
It's both sort of my going back after 20 years and reconnecting with people. And then for my daughter, she left when she was 4 years old. She was a victim of the Civil War there. And for her to go back and meet her family and aunts and uncles, and the emotion that came out of that, including memories of the Civil War, was very emotionally intense.
What are the parts of yourself that you hope your children take after?
My kids are great. I'm very proud of them. They're very caring. They're very compassionate. They definitely are very tight and take care of each other and really value family, but also really value, I think, helping other people as well.
Do they get to see you at work?
They have a few times, whether volunteering when they were little. We used to volunteer with children in the after-school program. I do come home and talk about work, including make sure you come to work on time, because if you're not, you're going to get fired. It's a really important life lesson. So they've definitely heard a lot of stories.
Mm. I'm just kind of wondering, growing up for you, what was the conversation like around the dinner table? Because, again, you were living in places that, you know, there is strife, there was war at times, and it's not exactly what it's like here.
So my dad worked a lot, so it wasn't quite so much, but I have a pretty clear memory of our entire elementary school being evacuated during the war between India and Pakistan, and we flew to Tehran, which at that point was a great place to be, and it was the first time I saw snow. So a little bit, again, different experiences. And then we went to Cleveland for Christmas, and we were the refugee children, so we got lots of great presents.
in the work that you do, what's the hardest thing about it for you?
I think the hardest thing for me is that there's, for every family we help, there's another family in need. And sort of the trauma that so many families experience when they become homeless or what's been happening in their life and how we can help provide hope and healing in that situation.
So how do you cope with that? How do you handle that dichotomy?
I also find my greatest inspiration from the families that we work with, that there's an incredible strength. Recently, my staff have been helping a young girl go to college. Her family's experiencing homelessness. They've never been to college. She got accepted to 18 universities. Helping her navigate that process and actually get to school on time is an amazing accomplishment, and we've changed her life. And so that's what inspires me. And then I think, okay, the next child, how do we help that one?
So you seem to have this attraction to people or situations where there's a lot of struggle. Mm-hmm. And you find the gift in there. Can you talk more to that in terms of some of the experiences that you've had?
Well, I mean, I think for me personally, I was born with in a very strong family. I've had a very strong education and just really feel this call to give back, to help those who've been struggling. And just so many times I've been amazed by the grace and the strength and sort of, I don't know if it's a miracle, but that people can really change their lives and make a difference. And so keeping that hope strong is important.
And who instilled that in you? Was that something you get from mom or dad, or was there somebody else that showed up in your life?
Well, I think both mom and dad, but different people I've met along the way. I was really reinforced when I was in the Peace Corps. I had a neighbor, an amazing woman who we went back to visit, who survived the Civil War, just didn't speak English, didn't read and write, never been anyplace else, and was a great person. And so just being able to meet those kind of special women along the, mainly women, but special people along the way.
Mm-hmm. So I would suspect 14 years ago when you took this job and now you've got this role that you've been playing, it's the same role. I'm assuming it has evolved.
It's changed a lot over the years.
How has it changed you?
Has it changed me? I think I've gotten good at letting the little things go, hiring good staff and letting them run their job, do their job, but also trying to really remain optimistic in the light of some serious challenges. And also, you know, we've taken on some big challenges. We did a $25 million capital project to build a new health center, and we're very successful on that. So that's also very personally very rewarding.
So how do you keep yourself kind of centered around all that?
For me, it's been really important to go home and spend time with my family and go on vacation and take time off and unplug and get a break and refresh and then go back to work ready to go again.
How old are your kids?
I have a 21-year-old and two 18-year-olds. The last one's a senior in high school. So
how would they describe their mom?
Oh, how would they describe me? They like hanging out with me. How's that for teenagers? I'm taking that as a big win and holding on to it. They liked going on vacation and spending time together, and it's a really gift.
That's wonderful. Thank you. What's the website?
It's communityofhopedc.org.
Thanks. We've been speaking with Kelly Sweeney McShane, President and CEO of Community of Hope. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment, right after this Business Spotlight.
And your name is?
Dana Theus.
And the name of the organization?
InPowerCoaching.com.
And what does InPower Coaching do?
Well, we support mid-level to senior managers mm-hmm. and leaders mm-hmm. Achieve professional success by developing themselves personally.
Why does this turn you on so much?
Well, I have found in my own experience and my own leadership journey mm-hmm. that the better I was at being a good human being, the better mm-hmm. leader and the better business I ran and mm-hmm. the more successful I was. And I want to help other people do that.
So you're able to help the folks in an organization throughout the organization achieve what they're looking for, as well as help the organization move forward.
Well, to move an organization forward, mm-hmm. you've got to master the soft skills of mm-hmm. dealing with people effectively. Mm-hmm. You've got to learn to negotiate every relationship successfully mm-hmm. for mm-hmm. both parties. Mm-hmm. You have to communicate confidently. Mm-hmm. I support people and help them learn to develop those skills themselves to be strong mm-hmm. leaders.
And you have a specialty working with women?
I do work a lot with women. Mm-hmm. They're drawn to this work, but not mm-hmm. exclusively.
Mm-hmm. And to learn more about what you're up to, is there a website address?
InPowerCoaching.com. That's InPowerCoaching.com.
Excellent. This has been your Business Spotlight.
Joining us for this Business Spotlight is Wes Burnett, partner at Optifor. Wes, what is Optifor?
Optifor is a securities firm that integrates legal, tax, and financial and risk in order to offer optimal results for clients.
Who's your perfect client?
Perfect client is someone who actually would like to combine services, make their life simpler, and is very family-oriented. Our firm itself is very family-oriented. We love helping families take care of their own, and that can be multi-generational.
So what would a family need when they would come to you?
Typically, what they're doing is trying to simplify their personal life by trying to have somebody else worry about their legal and their tax and financial affairs and present them with solutions rather than questions.
Solutions rather than questions. So So give us an example of a good solution.
Well, a good solution is something that results, for example, in the lowest tax bill, the greatest savings, and taking care of the values important to the family, like saving for college for children or grandchildren or something along those lines.
So what do you enjoy most about your work?
My clients. Although a second place, close would be my staff, because I recruit very specifically people who have the same values as our clients. So we truly are very involved with our clients' lives, and they are family to us.
What about your family? Are they in the business too?
No. Although there's certainly plenty of lawyers and financial advisors and so on in the business. But no, they all have their own lives, and we're very pleased, quite frankly, with that. I actually have a wife who's a teacher for 42 years, so I take a lot of my values from her.
What is the website?
Optifor.com, OPTIFOUR.com.
Thanks for listening to this Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Les Smolin, with my co-hosts, Mark Cohn, Joe Applebaum, and Kristen Vozo. It's my pleasure to introduce you to our next guest, Randy Tharp, founder, president, and CEO of Vet Sports. Welcome, Randy. Randy, what is Vet Sports?
Vet Sports is a nonprofit organization that helps veterans achieve better physical, mental, and emotional health through sports, physical activity, and community involvement around the country.
And how'd you get a job with them?
Well, I started the organization back in 2012 with two co-founders, Doc Jacobs and Brian Taylor Urella.
And what was the inspiration behind founding this company?
The inspiration behind it was my last year of service in the Army. There was something going on called Warrior Games, where all the military branches put together kind of an Olympics-type games. Well, the competition and teamwork and camaraderie of that really helped warriors in their recovery process, and it was amazing. But ultimately, there was only enough spots. It was very competitive, and these veterans in these games had to go home after their time in service. So we started Vet Sports with a mantra of everybody's included, everybody can be involved, and whenever you go home, Vet Sports will be there for you.
So what was happening for you at that time that said, this is what I need to be doing?
So at that time, and as I was leaving the service, I found myself, you know, lacking identity, that drive, that selfless service that made me join the Army in the first place. I was having a very difficult time finding that, and I didn't want to go down the street to a bar or to a brick and mortar institution and be around, you know, an area or individuals that weren't physically active and involved. So I knew that was the path I wanted to create, and since it didn't exist, we created it.
So something you had said earlier to us, in terms of how big, how large, you say you're national, you've got chapters, but you know, what would be a good indication of how big or small the organization really is?
I would say an indication would be we're able to help veterans anywhere in the nation now, because we're strategically located from the West Coast to the East Coast, and also we count our numbers by members who are actually involved. So around 540 veterans are continuously involved. So that's the numbers that we really, really count. Is how engaged.
That's on a weekly basis, you mentioned, right?
Yes, and it's the quality of the programs that really matter to us.
Good. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Michigan.
Were you brothers, sisters?
I had two younger brothers, so I was the oldest.
You're the oldest. And what was mom doing?
My mom was a single mom. She was a waitress and worked quite a lot.
So was she around when you were kind of growing up, or was that kind of left to you guys to fend for yourself?
Yeah, it was kind of left to us. I mean, my mom was doing what she could, and I think that's really what instilled that work ethic in all of us, you know, the sacrifices you have to make to take care of others. And so at a very young age, I was home with my brothers and helping them off the bus and getting home and fed.
Well, how old were you when you were doing that?
I would say very young, maybe around 7-8 years old. You know,
You had responsibility for your two younger siblings?
Yeah, I'd say so. I don't want to say full responsibility, like I was the man of the house, but it's ultimately, you know, it was my role as the older brother to be responsible for them.
Mm-hmm. And dad wasn't around?
No, my dad wasn't around. My parents were divorced when I was really young, around two.
So did that have an impact on you at all?
Definitely. It definitely made things difficult, you know, growing up in a home with just one parent. But I think you find strengths in each other and strengths outside of that and figure out how to make it work.
Randy, what was your relationship like with your siblings back then, and what is it like now?
We had a very, I want to say very common relationship growing up. You know, we're three very competitive boys, so there was a lot of wrestling, a lot of fighting, a lot of broken lamps. so that was always very, very fun, but stressful for my mom as well. But it was all well and good, and now we're all still pretty close.
So that wrestling actually landed you a scholarship to West Point, didn't it?
Correct. Well, it landed me a scholarship to wrestle at Grand Valley State University. I was accepted to West Point, but my mom talked me out of going, out of fears of having to go overseas.
And how did that turn out for her?
Not very good. You know, I followed her advice. I took the free ride to Grand Valley State, started wrestling, and after seeing the invasion on TV, I had this overwhelming sensation of just guilt that I should be there with guys my own age serving. And so I went down to the recruiting station and joined, and 6 months later I was in Iraq.
Why guilt of all things?
Guilt because at a very young age, for some reason, I knew that would be a path that I wanted to take, and I had that feeling of service, and ultimately I went against it. I said, you know, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to take the easy way out. Well, it's not an easy way out, but at the time, according to my parents, I was just going to go to college. So I did feel guilty.
You had said something also earlier to us in the green room just about this image of an Army individual. It must have been through an ad or something. Can you explain how that impacted you and what that was?
Sure. Being at a very young age and not having a dad around, and my brothers looking up to me, and I was the older brother saving them from being beat up on playgrounds quite often because they had big mouths. You know, you see soldiers on TV, and you know that image of strength and service and character really, really resonated with me, and I wanted to emulate that for my brothers growing up and be a role model.
Is it something today that they can relate to or at least acknowledge?
I would hope so, yes. My youngest brother, he did join the Army as well. So he had a great tour over in Germany, and he served over in Afghanistan a few times. So him and I are very close, and it's good to see that they took the steps that I took.
How do you think the Army shaped you? In what way, actually, is there something that you took away, something in particular that shows up today for you?
I would have to say leadership, as Joe mentioned earlier, that's so important. I mean, that's not something that you can just create or find out of business school. Leadership is something that's really developed inside. It's a drive. It's a passion. It's being able to get the masses to follow you on a vision and path. And I think the Army, out of all things, did that very well.
So you did the Army. You came out, you started this venture, and so you had stopped going to school. So school isn't important, right?
I wouldn't say that. There's a lot of people who would argue that point, but that I'm not one of them. I strongly feel school is very important. I tried really hard in high school, and was on the Honor Society and all that. So school is important, and I did go back to school, and I graduate next month from Catholic University with my business degree. Not because it's some degree I want to hang on the wall, but because I feel strongly that, you know, institutions like that with to give anybody that academia sense of what's going on in the world is important.
Thank you.
You had mentioned something as well about social entrepreneurship. You see yourself as a social entrepreneur?
I do.
Can you explain what that means for you and why it matters?
Sure. A lot of people want to be entrepreneurs or consider themselves, but an entrepreneur, in my eyes, is somebody who takes on a large challenge where there's a void in services, it's not being addressed, and you make the decision to start climbing up that mountain to see if you can make it work. And there's a lot of risk, and there's a lot of, you know, in a lot of thinking you have to do strategically on where I want this to go and what do I want this to look like. But yeah, it's very hard to do, and we were willing to take that chance.
So what did you, this void that you talked about earlier, what did you learn about yourself in doing what you've been doing that kind of fills the void for you?
I would say that, you know, especially in today's age, tying mission and service to an organization, whether it's for-profit, non-profit, I mean, that's what fills voids. You get such a high quality of people who wanna help and be involved if they can tie together their time and money and effort to the greater good, and I think that's really important.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a gala event coming up that we need to know about?
Oh, we do. May 16th, we have the Vet Sports Awards Gala, and that's our spin on the ESPYs, where we bring together veterans from around the country who've gone above and beyond, overcome significant challenges in their lives, and we give them awards and bring federal and IT industry leaders together for a very special evening.
Sounds great. Thank you. We've been talking with Randy Tharp, founder, president, and CEO of Vet Sports. Randy, what's the website?
It's www.vetsports.org.
Thanks, Randy. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this business spotlight.
And your name is?
David Shulman.
And David, the organization is?
Information Concepts.
And what makes Information Concepts special?
We're a fixed-price, full lifecycle custom software development shop.
Wait, your fixed-price software development. How long have you guys been around?
32 years.
So how do you manage to do that? You must have some very special processes to make sure that you sell what you can deliver with confidence and then deliver what you sell. Otherwise, you wouldn't be around this long. Do you have any repeat customers?
All our customers are repeat customers.
So you're telling me that customers buy software development from you because they know they get a fixed price. They know what they're going to get. Do you guarantee a timeline also?
Absolutely. Everything's guaranteed. Every screen, every process, every report, line item and priced, and every line item has a date.
Wait a minute. So you're telling me that all the interim processes are dated and priced so that when you get to the final result, there's no surprises?
Exactly.
Huh. And how long have you been doing this for?
We've been doing it 32 years. What we've done in the last few years, if I might, is develop a visualization process that allows the clients to actually see what we're going to build and take it out for a test drive and kick the tires without us writing a line of code.
What's the website address for this organization?
Infoconcepts.com.
Let me have that one more time.
Infoconcepts.com.
This has been your Business Spotlight.
Here for today's Business Spotlight is Chris Vannetti, Vice President of Contract and Project Staffing Services at Hire Strategy. Chris, what is Hire Strategy?
Hire Strategy is a D.C. Metro-based professional services and staffing firm specializing in information technology placements as well as HR and administrative, sales and marketing, and accounting and finance.
And what do clients love about working with Hire Strategy?
We take an old school approach to staffing. And what I mean by that is, you know, back in the day before social media and email, it was all about people. And we're one of the few and last firms in this marketplace, probably nationwide, that really interviews in person, takes the time to know their candidates, and 100% takes the time to know their clients, their pushes and pulls, the positives and negatives, to make the right match. So it's truly a consultative approach.
Mm-hmm. What do employees love about working for Hire Strategy?
It's definitely our culture. And the employees that work for us, I think they would all, to a person, say, we believe in leadership, not management. And that's one of our key mottos. And leading people is a definite thing that we like to do, and we like to do it often.
So what does that mean for a new employee? They get to be a leader?
They can get to be a leader, but they're a leader of their own practice, of their own business. We allow them to be entrepreneurial. We allow them to make their own decisions, and we're there to help them along the way, correcting them if need be. But motivation and leadership is the one way that we think that people are going to excel with us.
What do you love most about your job?
I love that I get the opportunity to be a leader and to be entrepreneurial and work with a great bunch of people and a great group of executives along with myself. So it's a great place to be.
What's the website?
The website is www.hirestrategy.com.
Thank you for listening to this Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Les Smolin, with my co-hosts, Mark Cohn, Joe Applebaum, and Kristen Bazzo. Our last guest is going to be Shai Palavani, founder of Live Safe. Welcome, Shai. Shai, what is Live Safe?
LiveSafe is a mobile app that college students can use to report safety and security-related issues to campus police, and it's been spreading word of mouth throughout the country on college campuses, but also being used in military bases and corporations.
And how big or small is it?
LiveSafe is a team in Arlington, Virginia, about 30 people.
And you mentioned earlier that 30 people doesn't really describe its impact, so you guys are national?
We are national, and we've been grateful to get employees that have all been a part of an incident or an issue previously, sexual assault, been a part of a mass shooting, unfortunately, robbery, muggings, and it's really inspired very passionate and mission-oriented employees across the country.
So you were mugged yourself at one point, weren't you?
Yep. I was held up at gunpoint on 12th Street in Capitol Hill and helped inspire the idea. But more powerful than my story is my co-founder, who's Christina Anderson, a survivor of the Virginia Tech shooting. She was in that final classroom. She took three bullet wounds. Thankfully, she survived and kind of become a mini-campus celebrity, talking about tools and things that could have helped her.
And how did the two of you get connected?
I was at JMU when that incident occurred, connecting with her. You know, when you hear these things in the news, you know, all of us can't help to get teary and emotional. I mean, just today, I think one of the biggest mass shootings on a college campus in history occurred, where 70 are dead at a Kenyan university. But that kind of stuff really inspires other people and put us together to come up with tools that could really help, you know, sharing information around preventing suicide, sexual assault, and mass shootings, where 80% of these cases, someone knew something and could have shared that information to help prevent that incident.
So one of the themes that kind of came out of the green room when we were first kind of talking about this was this theme of safety. It shows up in a lot of the work that you've been doing, not just currently, but even in the past. Can you explain what that is and where that thing has come from for you?
Yeah, for me, it's really, you know, when you work on a mission or social cause, it really helps inspire and empower other people to come work with you that believe in the cause, and it really makes it a lot easier. I've been a part of many other startups that haven't done as well, but when you can do something where you're really having an impact or solving an issue or keeping people safer, it's just incredible the kinds of people that you would never expect are willing to come offer up help or funding to help make the world safer.
Was the incident that happened at Virginia Tech the pivot for you?
It definitely was. It definitely was. We were college students at the same time, and the school is just a couple hours away from where I was attending at James Madison University, and it really affected our whole class. And I'm sure all of us can kind of think about where were we when that happened. So definitely.
And let's go back a little bit. Where did you grow up?
Grew up in Reston, Virginia. Born and raised here in Northern Virginia, and it's just a great hub for entrepreneurship and security. I wish I would have moved out to Silicon Valley after college, but it ended up being a positive staying out here on the East Coast.
So were you surrounded by entrepreneurs growing up?
My parents were entrepreneurs. All the conversation at the dinner table was always about money and business, and as a kid you found that to be the most boring thing in the world. But after leaving the house and going to college, those experiences and those insights really started kicking.
Did they know something you didn't know, that they figured if they planted the seed in you, this thing would somehow germinate later on?
I don't think so. My dad was more so complaining about how hard work was, how hard it was to make money, and really wanted me to be a doctor. So I was pre-med in college, but I had the opportunity to take business classes and hear other entrepreneurs speak, and it really inspired me to pursue a career in business.
So he wanted you to go help people, but medically.
That's correct. It'd be a lot better for my dad to say my son's a doctor as opposed to my son's working on this business. And every week he still calls me and he's like, "How's your business doing? Are you guys closing deals?" And I'm like, "Dad, we're in 25 states. Incredible organizations are using us." And he still every week he's like, "Are you guys closing deals?"
So education was important. You have two siblings, and I think your brother also went to law school?
Yeah, one of my co-founders, Iman Palavani, he graduated from UNH Law School. And I said, instead of going to be a lawyer and persuading people, you know, to your case in a courtroom, why don't you come do sales or business development for us? And he's been pretty good at it.
Pretty good. So being a professional is different than being a business person or a salesperson?
I think it could be one and the same. You know, his experience in the way analytical thinking and strategic thinking that he learned from law school is really applied within the business setting. So, you know, I definitely recommend a good academic education. And we tend to hire very, very smart people. Jules Weiss, who's in the room here, who's our director of University Partnerships, Cornell, and Georgetown grad. It's really important to hire very smart people who've had great education and then can fit into our culture.
So what happens when you have all these smart people around the table?
Yeah, it makes it easier for me, right? When you got smarter people in the room than yourself, it makes it a lot easier to run a company.
Even if they're your brother?
Even if they're my brother. You know, I think I won in the fact that he now works for me, but I think he makes more money than me.
So does ego get in the way here or not?
ego is something you definitely have to put aside as an entrepreneur. You've got to be very humble, willing to learn. And I've really taken that to heart, especially with our product. We really listen to feedback, and that's really important to building something that's successful and that can solve issues. You know, you can think you have the greatest idea, but you know, if you're not willing to iterate and take feedback, it's not going to go anywhere.
So we have Jules here at the table, and I have a question for her. Jules, what did you see when Shai and his brother are together and working on an issue?
I have to say, I think it's a great experience. Transparency is a really important value for a company to have, and integrity. And I think seeing both of them having these conversations, as you can imagine, sometimes even heated conversations about where you can see things going with the company, and some really great ideas that you hear talked about, not necessarily always in the most walls up professional way, but in kind of a family way. I think it inspires all of us to just be transparent and open with each other. So I think it's a great experience. It's funny sometimes, but it's a great experience.
What were you doing? What was your first job growing up?
My dad had me shoveling gravel at his concrete company. Until this day, I have a really, really bad back. So manual labor is just something of the past. I mean, put your kid to school and give him a computer.
So is that where the idea is, I think I'm going to focus on developing products, come from?
It does, definitely.
How old were you when you were shoveling, as you say, back then?
I was 12 years old.
12 years old. You get paid?
Yes, we did get paid, and that was very motivating as a kid to get a paycheck from dad and be able to manage that money and spend it. It's something I definitely encourage. I have a 3.5-year-old daughter. I can't wait to start giving her allowance and putting her to work at age 5. I'm really banking on my future with her.
What did you do with the money that you had earned?
I definitely don't remember. I probably spent it buying clothes or shoes.
So what was the thing you learned most about that first job?
Yeah, you learn hard work when you get to see your dad going to work every day, coming home stressed out and tired. It really inspires a strong work ethic, and you really, you got to work hard. And especially as an entrepreneur, you've got to work 24/7. It's just the adrenaline of not sleeping and just staying up late at night working hard. If there's a message to others out there, only doing this business for 2 years now, so if you have an idea, you want to be an entrepreneur, it's not very far from where you are and where I am. So just by working really hard and being passionate about the idea, taking feedback, anyone can kind of get to having a successful startup.
Mm-hmm. What about Mom? What was the thing you took from her?
Mom was also an entrepreneur, worked very closely with my dad. So that was very important for me to see as well, that a female can also play a strong role in leadership and in business. So I really learned that from my mom. And we tend to hire, our products towards females, but we try to hire females as well to make sure we understand what's going on in the market. And we tend to put females in leadership roles as well.
Is that the focus of your business? Is it on women in particular, or is this something also that men have to be concerned about?
I think it's something men have to be concerned about as well, but if you think about college males, we kind of feel like we're invincible, where 70% of our users are female. So through the stats, we've kind of learned that, when you're walking home late at night, a lot of us turn around and look to make sure we're walking home safely. So we have a feature called Safe Walk. So a lot of our features are geared towards walking home late at night or feeling unsafe in situations, and I think that can be male or female.
Thanks, Shai. Shai, what's the website address?
It's livesafemobile.com.
Thanks. Mark, we've had a great lineup of guests. Can you run through it for us, please?
Sure, Les. First, we talked to Joe Martori, the CEO and president of Caliber Systems. Then Randy Tharp, the founder, CEO, and president of Vet Sports. Third was Kelly McSweeney McShane, the president and CEO of Community of Hope. And we just heard from Shai Pallavani, founder of Live Safe.
Thanks. I'd like to thank my co-hosts, Mark Cohn, Joe Applebaum, and Kristen Vazo, for helping develop our storylines and hopefully delivering to our listening audience an entertaining and educational show. And I'd like to thank our listening audience for listening. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a radio show. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. You can hear the show again at businesstalkradio.net. Have a great day. Bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTLP FM HD2 Braddock Heights Frederick, the Washington, D.C. home of Navy Athletics. Listen each week for Tech Tuesday on Federal News Radio. Every Tuesday, we zero in on how technology inspires innovation. Tuesday mornings at 11, it's Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy, the latest on products that help bring policy to life. Then Tuesday afternoons at 12:30, join Federal News Radio's Jason Miller for Ask the CIO. Federal News Radio's DoD Wednesday. At 3, DoD reporter Jared Serbu hosts On DoD, a discussion with senior managers about how the department meets its mission. At 4, in-depth host Francis Rose brings you Pentagon Solutions, a smart discussion on the issues and challenges of the defense community. Plus daily DoD updates, mornings and afternoons, Monday through Friday. DoD Wednesday on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
This paid commercial may not